Shonali, what is it about the Yiddish tradition that's so steeped in stories? I mean, does it go back to biblical times, perhaps?
I think with the Yiddish, it's more that it's an oral language. It's not really written down that much. And the best way to communicate in that sense is through a story. But I think if you look at the whole Jewish culture, all our ceremonies, all our high days and holy days, it's all based around stories. You've got the story of Passover, you've got the story of Esther at Purim. So all of our festivals have very poignant stories that have been told. So in a time when everybody else is discovering storytelling, I think it's just always been a part of the way that we are, and also being a nomadic people to a certain extent, and with the diaspora, as in any culture that's suffered that, you can't carry the books with you. You carry, like most people, the memories. And how do you tell a memory? Well, it becomes a story. It becomes something that gets passed on from generation to generation. So I think, yes, it probably does go back to biblical times when you're schlepping around in the desert. but we value books and we value that. But there was a long time when it was illegal to own books in Hebrew or Yiddish. So people would tell the stories. It was safer, it was easier. So it's ingrained, I think.
There are some cultures, though, that seem to be better at keeping the traditions and the stories. The British don't seem so good at it.
Well, that was interesting. We were having a discussion up at the house, because all the storytellers are staying in the same house, well, most of us. And so you can imagine what meal times are like. Like six storytellers around a table. It's like, it's a wonder we ever eat the food while it's hot. But we were talking about that, and I have a theory, and it's just my theory. But I've travelled all over the world, really, telling stories now. And the one thing I've noticed is in cultures that have been repressed, where they have had their language and their culture and their identity, in some cases their children, their written, their artwork, where they've had everything taken away from them, the oral tradition still survives. It goes back to the original, the first question, you know. You can hold it in your head as a memory. And it's very interesting that the English have never really been repressed, so they have no need to hold anything orally. They can write it down in books. Whereas the Gaelic, the Welsh, Irish, Scottish, Cornwall even, India, the Jewish communities of the north, the Sephardic communities of the south, Morocco, Afghanistan, all of these places where the indigenous culture has been suppressed, Jamaica, you know, all of those still seem to have a strong oral tradition. And I'm sure it's because when everything else is taken away from you, the human spirit is unquenchable, isn't it? It will find a way. And what most basic of ways but to communicate via stories and an oral tradition. So I think that's why you find that the cultures that have kept their oral tradition have maybe done so through need to start with, but then it becomes almost a matter of pride. I think the Irish, especially being there, are very proud of the fact that they are great storytellers. They still have a strong tradition. The Welsh as well, you know, the Scottish, a strong tradition of storytelling.
Where were you first aware of hearing stories?
When I was about 7 years old, and I used to creep down and listen, and they used to tell all the fruity stories in Yiddish, so and if they were talking about something they didn't want us to know about, they used to talk in Yiddish, so I was determined to learn it, you know. I think listening to my grandmother, listening to the fact that in our house, it was the most natural thing in the world for me. You know, we had roots Turkish, Dutch, Polish, all these different people in our house as musicians and storytellers. And I just thought that's how everybody lived. And then within my own community, you know, obviously all the celebrations, stories were told. So it's something I've always been aware of. But also, my mother was a nurse. When we lived in England, my grandmother lived with us. And it was the biggest treat in the world that, you know, Mama would be getting up early to start a shift at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I would crawl into my grandmother's bed and just curl up with her. And this was before I went to school, so you know, it must have been about 7 o'clock in the morning. And she would tell me a story while the rest of the house were running around, you know. She would tell me a story, and that was the perfect way to start the day. It was a safe, wonderful place to be. And you know how you always associate things? You know, fruit-flavoured polos? Do you remember that? I think they've brought them back, haven't they? Grandma always used to have fruit-flavoured polos under the pillow, and my mother never let me eat sweets in bed because otherwise your teeth would drop out. And Gran would always say, oh, have a polo while you listen. And it was like fruit-flavoured polos and a story with a height of decadence on a morning. So that's the earliest memory.
But like many people these days, she wasn't reading these stories from a book, was she?
Oh, no, no. She was telling them out of her head, and you could see that she was seeing them. And for me, you know, it didn't matter what story she was telling, whether it was, you know, why the sea is salty or, you know, very folk tales. It was like she was telling me things that she remembered. You know, they weren't stories. They were my grandmother's memories. It was only till I got older I realised these were folk tales that she was telling me. They weren't things that had happened to grandmother, but the way she spoke, it was as if she was there. There was this quality about it, you know. I could see the pictures as vividly as she could.
So, in adulthood, I guess these stories never left you. I mean, the shame of it is, I suppose, us adults, we don't allow ourselves to hear stories a lot of the time, do we?
No, I think we live our life at such a fast pace. It's like we don't have time for that. We have time for lots of rubbish, but it's like we don't really have time to sit and listen. Not really. I think we hear things, but we don't actually listen to them. I've noticed, actually, when you're telling a story, people, it's like they step out of time. It's quite interesting, the number of people that come up and say, do you know, for the last 2 hours, I've forgotten about the tax and the this and that. It was like I was somewhere else. I mean, it's almost like that, you know, you step into the fairy hill and you come out and 6 months has passed. I do a lot of work in OAP homes, and they people that they have the time to listen. And you know, usually they'll book you for an hour. And if I know I'm going, I don't book anything afterwards, because what tends to happen is you'll start with your stories, and actually they're much better at it, you know. And this whole conversation will start, and it's like life just changes gear and slows down. And it's... I think we would have a much more tolerant world and a much more understanding if people just stopped and listened and, listened to stories a bit more, I think.
So did you feel destined to carry on this tradition of storytelling?
No, not to start with. I wanted to be a famous actress and work for the Royal Shakespeare Company. It just happened by accident, really. My gran was due to do something. I knew the stories. She was ill. I stepped in. And for a couple of years, it worked like that. And then I realised, actually, I thought, this is what I want to do. You know, as an actor, one minute you're doing Shakespeare and the next minute you're a dancing tomato, and it was not very fulfilling. But with stories, it's like I could decide what I told. Moreover, the audience decides what you tell. It was immediate and wonderful, and I don't mean this to sound arrogant, but it was so easy. It was like I'd finally, being dyslexic, I'd always struggled. And finally, it was something that I loved to do. I actually couldn't believe that I could do it, because it seemed so easy. And I suddenly realised it is. That's all you need to do is tell the stories.
And there's quite a lot of personal stuff that you put into your stories. I mean, particularly the Jewish humour.
I can't really help it. It's quite bizarre, actually. Sometimes I'll be telling a story. I was telling a story from Japan the other day, and my mother, just out of nowhere, put in a guest appearance. It was like the mother turned round and said, so, you've met a nice young man. And I thought, crumbs, that's my mother. I actually had to stop. It was like she'd suddenly appeared there next to me. And, humour, I don't know, it makes the unbearable bearable. It also is, it's just a great way to get people's attention. But I actually don't realise I'm doing it a lot of the time. I have a very visual sense of humour. Stories are about creating pictures in people's heads. And I think, you know, the two go together very well. And humour is a great way to communicate a point as well. And it's a great way to you know, when there is discord, it's a great way to dispel that. When there is misunderstanding, it's a great way to create a dialogue. When there is anger and resentment, it is a wonderful way to build bridges.
And another aspect of Jewish stories, food comes up quite a bit, doesn't it?
It does.
Whether it be pork chops in Stamford Hill or the one that we're going to hear about, the kugel.
The kugel is a type of potato pudding that was cooked on a Friday for nourishment purposes. It was cheap, it was quick, it was easy, and you didn't need to keep cooking it. It would cook itself. Joschko Fomonski loved kugel. In fact, there was nothing better that he looked forward to on a Friday night, despite rabbinical injunctions concerning private marital duties. And so every Friday, Mrs. Fomonski would bake and cook the kugel. And she would hate kugel. She loathed kugel and she despised kugel because every time Joschko came home, he would eat the entire kugel and fall fast asleep, despite rabbinical injunctions concerning private marital duties. Well, this is why every Friday you could find Mrs. Fomonski taking a knife and stabbing it into the kugel over and over again, hoping just to see a little bit of kugel blood, but she never did. You know, at first, when they'd first got married, she thought maybe he was having an affair, so weak and inconsequential was his desire. And then she thought, he can't possibly be, he's a tailor, he works hard. And so she would, on a Friday night, open all the windows in the tailor's shop, but Joschko just ended up getting a cold. And then, realising it was the kugel, she took to making the kugel a little less stodgy. A kugel is a potato pudding. How can you make a potato pudding less stodgy? She would try putting less cheese or less potato. She would make the soup a little thinner, the chicken a little leaner, the fish less oily. She even tried putting herbs into it to keep Joschko awake, but unfortunately he was the sort of man to whom Valium was a stimulant, so nothing worked. He would come home, he would eat the meal, he would eat the kugel, he would fall asleep. And then, well, it's a sad thing to say, and you'll probably be shocked, she decided she must use her womanly wiles, and Mrs. Fomonski bought a negligee like the Polish women wore. And on one Friday night, well, the winciette was whipped off in a flurry of frivolity and the negligee was donned. She lay there in the bed awaiting Joschko, but did anything happen? Absolutely nothing. Despite rabbinical injunctions concerning private marital duties, Joschko came home, he ate the kugel, he came to bed, he fell fast asleep, and she lay there thinking about how her mother had warned her of the evil that men do in the bedroom. And just for once, she wished she'd married one of those men, I tell you. But then she did what all women do. She started to blame herself. She said, Joschko, don't you love me anymore? He said, of course I love you. I just love kugel. She said, then I'll cook you no more kugel. He said, woman, you cook me no more kugel, I'll divorce you. Well, what was she supposed to do? She loved her husband. Which is why, every Friday, you could find Mrs. Fomonski stabbing away at the kugel. And on this particular Friday night, when she'd finished stabbing and she was putting the kugel back into the oven, well, the kugel leapt past her and flew to the top of a cupboard, where it seemed to smirk starchily at her. And she looked up, and then the kugel shot across to the other side of the room, and this woman had seen off several Cossacks. She was a stout and proud housefrau. She grabbed a broom, and she gave chase. Over the table, under the chairs, round the back of cabinets, over and under, round and round, all the while the kugel singing selections from Fiddler on the Roof. And finally, the kugel shot back to the top of the cabinet, and she was there while it finished off the last verse of If I Was a Rich Man. When she sank to her knees and said, "Oh, if potatoes can sing, it's the end of the world." And then the kugel spoke. Well, she'd spent the last 5 minutes trying to kill it. It seemed churlish not to listen to what it had to say. It said, "Mrs. Fomonsky, I'm here to help." And she looked a little stunned. She said, "You're a kugel." He said, "But in my life, I was the great wonder-working rabbi of Dalgasco." Said Mrs. Fomonsky. The great rabbi that would make the blind to see, the lame to walk, the stupid to think? The very same. And she looked at the kugel. She said, "Rabbi, how did you come to this?" He said, "Well, in my life, I was a good man. But one day, while discussing and trying to teach my wife a particularly intricate point of Talmudic law, well, she didn't seem to understand. And the more I explained, the less she understood, until finally I turned round to her and I said, 'Oi! You have the brains of a kugel.' And she cried, and I had never seen tears on that face before. And in that moment I felt so awful that I swore I would never say another unkind thing to another living soul. And I didn't. And I was rewarded, and I became the great wonder-working rabbi of Dalgasco. But you see, God likes a balance. And when I died and went to paradise, there was a great argument. Some said I should go to Gehenna for what I had done. Because, you see, in most lives, the kugel incident would have been lost in a sea of mediocrity. But in my blameless life, it stood out like a beacon. They argued and they discussed until finally it was decided that I would be allowed to go back to Earth in the very form with which I insulted my wife to repair some domestic disharmony, and if I succeeded, I would be allowed to enter heaven. Mrs. Fomonsky looked and she said, 'You're a kugel. He'll eat you.' 'This is my plan,' said the kugel." Now, when Yoshko Fomonsky came home that night, the candles were lit, the wine was poured, the soup was served, and the fish was feasted upon. The chicken was eaten with relish, and finally the kugel, steaming and hot before Yoshko. And he salivated, and he licked his lips, and he reached forward, and he pulled the entire kugel towards him, meaning to consume the lot, when a rasping, starchy sort of voice said, "Yoshko Fomonsky, we are fed up with being made an occasion for your sin." "Sin?" said Yoshko. "Sin," said the kugel. "Every Friday night, despite rabbinical injunctions concerning private marital duties, do you?" "No, you don't." "But what is Friday night? But, you know, what else was it created for? But a little teaching, a little relaxation, a little stooping. And we are fed up with being blamed. We will not be made an occasion for your sin. So me and the whole tribe of Kugelin have got together, and we have decided, Yoshko, should you ever be remiss in the duties to your wife again, should one piece pass your throat, a kugel will rip it out." And Yoshko paled. "And," said the kugel, "a bunch of pickled kugelin have got together, and should we ever find you remiss in your duties to your wife, they will bite it off. And believe me, Yoshko, some things that are bitten off can never regrow. Yoshko Fomonsky, do not make us an occasion for your sin." And Yoshko paled. And he pushed the kugel away with trembling hands, and he declared to his wife that he'd completely lost his appetite, but for food alone. And he took his wife by the hand and led her to the bedroom where they led a normal married life. And the kugel, it sprouted wings and disappeared heavenwards out of the window. And I know that the story's true. I know it's true because that Mrs. Fomonsky, that sainted Mrs. Fomonsky, who found her destiny as a woman through a bunch of crushed potatoes to which the right heat was eventually applied, was my great-great-grandmother.
Shona Lee, how do you develop a story? How does it come to you? Or how do you go to it?
That's a question I could spend the next hour answering. How do I develop a story? Well, first of all, I never tell a story I don't like. I never tell a story because I feel like I should tell it. So from that point of view, I think the stories come to you. You know, you can hear 100 stories and they won't speak to you. And then one, you'll think, that's wonderful, I don't quite know how to tell it, but I love the sentiments in it. So, for example, again, a story that was told by a teller yesterday, I've heard that story loads and never really wanted to tell it. I thought the way they did it was brilliant, but I wouldn't have done it that way and it wouldn't have worked. It's not my story. So if I find a story that I like, I then try and find as many different versions of that as possible to see the different clothes it's worn in the past, if you like. And then I find out what the heartbeat of that story is. What is it saying? Why am I drawn to it? And what do I want people to feel at the end of that story? And then it's, I think, like making a garment. It's very slowly I pick and I think, and I actually do a lot of dreaming. I'm dyslexic, so a lot of my ideas come while I'm asleep. I don't think there's anything mystical about it. I think it's just my ideas sorting themselves out. And then very slowly you'll end up with probably the bare bones. You know, this happens, and then that happens, and that's the conclusion. And I'll go and tell that to someone like my mother. And once that's in place, you know, she'll either go, well, that was a bit boring, or, oh, I thought that was a bit interesting. And then you'd start to clothe it, you start to sort of give it your own voice and move it forward. And then after you've told it about three times to a fairly innocuous audience that usually consists of the dog, my child, my mother and the microwave, you tend to have a shape for it. And then the first time you do it in front of an audience, it comes alive. That's really the first time you as the teller hear it properly as well.
And for performing an epic, do you live with that for months, if not longer? And how is it living with that story within you?
I've been carrying a story around for 18 months at the moment. It's a bit like giving birth, actually, but worse. You live with it. You make sense of it. It's almost like it becomes part of you, especially when you're working with the big material. I mean, I'm about to start a huge project, and I've been kind of gathering material. Something will happen during the day and it will take me back to that story. So, you know, something as simple as a bird gliding over the water, and you think, oh, that reminds me of that moment in the story, an image. And so it's like stepping stones. And it's a bit like getting to know a person. It becomes like a relationship. It really is. It's like getting to know a person or a child, I suppose, and then you finally make sense of it and you tell it. And then it's a bit like watching your child go out and it suddenly belongs to everybody else as well. And you've no idea now where that story's going to end up, because by the very nature of the oral tradition, people will listen and think, oh yeah, I'd like to tell that story. And they will go and they'll do something different. So it's quite a strange thing. I don't know whether others, you get quite possessive because it's your baby. And the minute you tell it, it's like sending your child off to university. You have no idea what's going to happen from that moment, and you have to let it go.
What's that about? Is it throwing up an apple and thanking the storytellers who've been before?
Yeah, three apples fell from the sky, yeah, and into the hands of the storyteller. And the first apple is thrown behind you as thanks for all of those that told the story before and allowed it to rest in your hands. And the second apple is given to the audience for listening and for now taking it on its further journey. And the last apple is given to the storyteller as sustenance and thanks for the story.
So, Shonali, before you get your apple, could you give us one more story?
Yes, of course. This is a story that is often told at weddings and celebrations, and it's about a menorah. A menorah is a 7-branch candlestick that you usually see in the windows we use for high days and holidays and holy days and power cuts. Very useful. And it goes like this. In the city of Ur, there was two families, the Goldbergs and the Feldmans. And the Feldmans were very, very poor. They had absolutely nothing, but they had a lot of friends, and maybe that made them quite rich. And the Goldbergs Well, they were so rich that they didn't know what to do with all their money, but they were so mean. They would not lend you a thing. They wouldn't lend you or give you the time of day. They would walk around the streets with their hand over their mouth and nose, not because of the smell of the streets, but because, well, if you wanted any breath from a Goldberg, you had to pay for it. Now, the Feldmans had a daughter and she was getting married, and Mrs. Feldman had borrowed and begged from all of her friends. She had a beautiful linen tablecloth, she had the crystal glasses, she had the fine cutlery, everything was perfect. And she even approved of her son-in-law, which for a Jewish mother, well, it's almost impossible. But there was one thing she didn't have, a traditional thing that she wanted. She wanted a silver menorah to sit at the head of the wedding table. But they didn't have one. The Goldbergs had one, but, well, they wouldn't lend you anything, let alone a silver menorah. And then Mr. Feldman, he looked at his wife, and he said, "Do you trust me?" And she'd been married to this man for all of her life. Why shouldn't she trust him? So she said, "Yes, of course." Mr. Feldman made his way to the Goldbergs' house. He went round the back to the servants' entrance, and he knocked on the door. And the servant girl opened the door, and Mr. Feldman looked her full in the eye and said, "Can I have a teacup?" She said, "A teacup?" He said, "Yes, a teacup." So she hesitated for a moment and then lent him one. Well, it was cracked. It was going to go in the bin. It wouldn't do any harm. But 3 days later, he came back, again knocking on the door, and when she opened it, in one hand he had a teacup, and in the other a beautiful little coffee cup. And she looked really puzzled, and he smiled, and he said, "Well, it's the strangest thing. But the other night, there was a moaning and a groaning and an awful noise, and when I opened the cupboard door, the teacup had given birth. It was amazing. So I'm giving them both back to you." And while she was still stunned, he turned around and said, "By the way, could I borrow a milk jug?" And she never said a word. She just handed him one. Anyway, a few days later, he again knocked on the door, and when she opened it, in one hand he had the original milk jug, and in the other a little crystal cream jug. And when she looked at him quizzically, he said, "I know, the same story, a moaning and a groaning and a terrible noise, and I opened the cupboard door and the milk jug had given birth. Well, you shouldn't separate a mother from its child, so I'm giving them both back to you." Well, absolutely stunned, the maid ran to Mrs. Goldberg. She said, "The crockery is giving birth." And Mrs. Goldberg said, "That's fantastic. We won't ever have to buy anything else again. Let me know if the funny little man comes back." Of course, when he came back in a few days and said, "Could I borrow the silver menorah?" Normally he would have been sent packing, but the maid ran to Mrs. Goldberg and said, "He wants to borrow the silver menorah now." And Mrs. Goldberg said, "Lend it. You never know, he might have twins." So the menorah was lent, it was polished, it was placed at the head of the wedding feast, and it had never felt so proud. Normally it was covered in dust, it was ignored, but now it burned so brightly. Ah, it shone its heart out. 3 days became 4, 4 days became 7, 7 days became 10, and all the while Mrs. Goldberg awaiting the return of several menorahs. And when nothing had happened by the 14th day, she sent the maid round to Mr. Feldman's house. And Mr. Feldman opened the door and he looked at her, tears spilling down his cheeks, and he said, "I know, I didn't know how to tell you, but oh, the other night, from the pantry, such a moaning and groaning, such a terrible noise, and I opened the door and your menorah has died." And he handed her a small piece of silver tin. And she looked at it and she thought, "What am I going to tell Mrs. Goldberg?" But she went and she told her that the menorah died. And Mrs. Goldberg said, "What am I going to tell Mr. Goldberg? Because I haven't even told him the crockery is giving birth." But nevertheless, she went and she told him about the crockery, the milk jug, the cutlery, and finally that the menorah had died. He said, "You stupid woman." He said, "You stupid woman." And he took the whole thing to court. But the judge was a fair man. He said, "If you are foolish enough to believe that a teacup can give birth, if you are stupid enough to believe that a milk jug can give birth, then the only ruling I can give is that you have to believe that a menorah can die." Case dismissed. It was thrown out of court. Which is why, if you still go to the city of Ur, in the poor quarter there is a silver menorah, which you may borrow if you're having a wedding, whether you are rich or poor.
Shanali.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.